I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to season 5 of And the Writer Is with your host, Ross Golan. Before I give my spiel, I want to acknowledge the music army that listens to this podcast every week. Since starting this, the And the Writer Is community has literally changed the history of the music business by helping pass the Music Modernization Act, gotten songwriters added to Album of the Year for the Grammys, and still is advocating for positive changes for our industry on a daily basis. So thank you and congrats. Now, as you know, I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special live events, or buy that merch, aka that hat I always wear, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. This week's episode is sponsored by BMI. Full disclosure, Joe and I are both BMI songwriters. So we didn't write this, but we believe it. BMI, we celebrate your talent, value your music, and champion your rights. To all our songwriters and composers, your passion is ours. BMI, music moves our world. This episode is brought to you by Abco Music, home to iconic music catalogs of the 20th century, including Sam Cooke, Ray Davies, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, and Bobby Womack. Rewind. Mick Jagger, Keith Richards. They've also been an advocate for the songwriting community for more than 50 years. So check out www.abco.com. That's ABKCO.com. Songwriters, think about your favorite hit song and what makes it an earworm. You could be the writer behind the next song that goes viral. Enter the 20th annual NSAI Song Contest presented by Martin Guitars and Strings and CMT. You could win several prizes, including the one-on-one mentoring session with L. King, myself, and fellow And the Writer Is producer Joe London. The lyric-only winner will score $2,000 cash and mentoring session with award-winning songwriter Tom Douglas, as well as other coveted prizes. Send in your best songs now through October 31st at nsai.cmt.com. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan, today's alt-rock superhero and multi-platinum songwriting producer has not just fronted his own successful rock band, but helped shape the zeitgeist by defining so many others. His unique musical intuition has maintained relevancy over 20 years. Now, we've been friends since we wrote at a writing camp in Aspen in 2012, which goes to show that writing camps aren't only about writing, but also about meeting people. But I digress. It was there that I learned that this left coaster's standout qualities is his humor and humility. That feels like that might be grammatically incorrect, but I'm gonna keep it. Anyway, I should just shut up and dance. Woo! And the writer is my friend, Tim Pagnotta.
Dude, thank you. That was one hell of an introduction. I feel like, will you send that to me after the hang?
No.
That needs to be like,
you will once it's up. It'll be your entrance music.
Yeah, I want to put that on a Christmas card that goes out to all my enemies.
Oh my God.
Just the face off.
Like, do you have people, because you're like you seem like somebody who's never had an enemy in his life. Are there people, do you have a shit list?
Well, dude, the pop punk world could be pretty brutal. I don't remember there was. I don't know about. Like,
I have a shit list, so enemy. Everyone has a shit list. But do you have a shit list?
I don't know if I have like enemies. I definitely there's like if you're putting yourself out there, there's definitely a certain amount of trolling here and there.
Yeah. Are there people that you're proving wrong?
I don't know. I don't know if it's as deep as that. Maybe just just a few chatter here and there. I think there was a minute, like, in the pop punk world where you'd read everything that someone would write about you back when you were in a band, and, oh, it would fucking cut deep. Or, of course, you like, make a record, pour your heart and soul into an album, and write and produce and be a part of, like, what you feel is, like, the best thing you've worked on, and then you hear a couple of bad reviews. There's a famous quote out there I think David Lee Roth has where it's like, and I'm going to fully botch it. I'm going to pull the George Bush where you're on the spot and completely just ruin the quote. There's a famous quote where it's just like,
fool me once, fool me twice.
And then he passed out and cried. Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I think there is the David Lee Roth quote is somewhere along the lines of, it's like when I, whatever, it's like when I see something good about me, it's like on whatever level 7. And when I read something bad about me, it's like negative 100. So I'll take what you wrote, and that will be that's like the new mission statement for my life. That's the big with a Xerox middle finger.
Why is it that artists have, because I think a lot of us have that intuition.
Or insecurity.
Or insecurity. No, yeah. That's right. I mean, if I have, doubt, if I have 1,000 comments and...
you read
and 998 of them were positive, but 2 were like, this is trash.
Oh, yeah.
I would for sure think that I need to address those 2 notes.
I know. We do it, like, I was on Yelp the other day. I can't remember what I was looking up, but I was, like, seeking out the 1 star. And... And like, man, this person got really nasty. They didn't get a callback from the business or whatever. But yeah, in terms of what we do, well, I mean, we put ourselves out there so much and rally the room so hard to get behind an idea. And I've had, you know, by the way, like everyone's a critic now. That's also such a difficult thing, and everyone has a platform. And there's obviously so many reasons why, you know, social media has been amazing, and the ability to be able to throw your opinions out there is awesome. But the double edged sword is, yeah, you like you'll discover some shit out there that's not very, very pleasant, and it still rocks your boat a bit. I was talking about the same thing with a friend of mine, like. You know, and we'll get onto this a little bit later, but just because it kind of came up recently, like I just worked with Blink on a couple songs on their new record, and when they released the first single, I'm so psyched. It's this complete mix of emotions. Songs come out, it's getting played on K-Rock like 5 times a day, and I'm looking up to see what, you know, the responses are and how people are digging it. Just thinking like, man, it's going to be awesome. People are freaking out. The sound's so new. It's so fresh. And people are like, what the fuck did this guy do to my favorite band? Oh, my God. And like there is cover songs of people covering the song, doing it as they thought would be a better version of it. And it kind of bummed me out. It was
Did any of them nail it? Did you listen to him?
There's actually one arrangement where I was like, there's a couple. Yeah, I like that. Good. I like the guitar part. That was pretty sweet. Can we lift that? Maybe put it in like the remix?
Do you know the Theodore Roosevelt quote about this?
No.
Okay, ready?
Bring it.
It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. But who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement And who, at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat. That's a great quote.
That's
about
a great quote. That'd be a long reply text. I don't know if it would fit in the body of a response, but
so
I love the spirit. Yeah.
Just Neil's a genius to be like, you know, it's like the critic doesn't do shit. Their job is to give an opinion, which is really interesting. Why isn't music just enjoyed or not enjoyed?
I mean, that's a deep philosophical question. I don't know if I have the answer to that.
What kind of music do you enjoy?
I mean, I love everything. God, you know, if this would go back, this would have to go back pretty far. So I can talk about like the first time, you know, some of my first introductions to music.
Sure, let's start from the beginning. Yeah, so let's go there. You're.
So I was born in in San Diego.
Okay.
So I'm a little bit of a California rat.
Parents are your parents siblings?
Yeah, I was born in 2000, so that makes me 19.
You've been 19 a while,
a long time.
Yeah.
No, I was a kid of the 80s.
Okay.
Early 80s, possibly late 70s, but we'll probably edit that
out.
We're splitting hairs. I'm only like 15 years away from like the AARP club, right?
Right. Where you get
discounts at Costco for everything. So
the truth of that hurts.
Yeah, oh God, so painful. Stay young, kids. Just
stay young.
Stay in that cryogenic chamber. Is that what the
cryo?
No, I was a kid I'm a California rat. So I grew up in San Diego. My dad was actually in the Navy, and my mom was an Army nurse.
The San Diego.
The San Diego, like Miramar base was like it was the Navy base down
there.
What
was your dad in the Navy?
He ended up retiring as a captain. Uh-huh. So he got pretty far.
Yeah.
But then they ended up having career changes, and he went into like the tech world. They were really focused and serious on, you know, with business. And my mom went from being an Army, overprotective Army nurse, to then selling real estate.
Were they strict the way you envision military parents to be?
Not really. Yeah. It's funny. They're pretty liberal. Like especially now, their political views have always been pretty liberal, like which kind of bucks the norm, I think, typically for military families. And there was instruments around the house. I think they're like, you know, there were leftover instruments from the 60s, you know, folk guitars, piano. I remember at an early age, my mom would be singing. She can sight read music. She's like somewhat of a real musician in that regard, where, you know, there would be a lot of carols around the holidays and stuff like that, and sing-alongs But they had the record. They had like a reel to reel and a record collection. And my parents were pretty into music as a kid. So there was like the sacred stereo in my parents' room that for the most part was pretty off limits until like one day I was taught how to use it. And the records at the time were like Huey Lewis in the News.
That's my first concert.
Oh, that stuff is just, that is like the best music ever.
Yeah.
Like if I could do that over and over again, that would be an amazing life.
Yeah.
Just make records like that. And I try to, by the way. There's always a little Huey Lewis in everything. For sure.
I was getting, so but cheeky. I mean, that's true. There's a sense of humor.
Oh yeah.
In a lot
and they're
of
so
it.
So like that, and then like big 80s records, Duran Duran, Cyndi Lauper,
Tears for Fears.
Tears for Fears, all that stuff, Michael Jackson. So that was like...
NXS, maybe. That's probably later.
That was a little bit later. And that was when I really started noticing production, because that was like a separate thing. You start realizing how like certain records sound better than other albums. Some albums were a little more of a live performance where you could kind of hear air in the room, and then others were like the most hi-fi. It was like a renaissance period of records and production and all of these extra tools to help enhance the songs. So I grew up in San Diego and just studied these records as a kid. I didn't really start picking up an instrument till there was a nearby neighbor misfit that had a drum set with like a crazy, and now this is still the 80s where like every drum set was required to have like six more toms than necessary.
And a double bass.
Yeah, it was like super dialed. Exactly. Not even just, not a double bass drum, because that would be too expensive.
Right.
The pedal's the like pedal. The cheat code for it. And so there was a kid up the street that had one of those, and we would just blast Van Halen songs and try to memorize the fills. And like, and speaking of fills, Phil Collins, another huge.
But all that music, all those influences are more song-esque versus the, you know, the remnants of Kiss or the, you know, that the real hair metal. Like, you're not mentioning Def Leppard. You're not really mentioning
Poison. No, but I kind of got into that.
Warrants
I did.
All that.
A little later on, I actually got into that, And I'll finally bring it up. I don't think I've ever, like, really talked about how much I really dug Poison and Bon Jovi, Warrant, probably all of the records that like real metalheads hated. It was like,
it was the pop, it was the She's My Cherry Pie.
Oh, I love
and
that
stuff
band.
Like that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, that band was awesome. I think they're from Glendora.
Did you go see these bands live?
No, I was still a kid. So then I was still like probably fourth or fifth grade, but I was still really into music, and that was like in the era of making mixtapes for all your friends, and another kid like moved in the neighborhood. That was like the thing where it's, you know, and someone new would move in that had some more like badass, dangerous music taste than you did, make you a mixtape. You're hearing Led Zeppelin for the first time. Maybe someone's like busting out a joint for the first time, and you're way too young to be getting into that kind of like craziness.
For example, did that actually happen?
Oh yeah. I mean, that was like, I feel like we were wild.
What was your instrument at that point? Guitar,
okay. So
right?
No. So my parents, I got off track. So my parents somehow, I don't know what the fuck they were thinking, but we begged. I would get like a toy drum set every Christmas, and we would destroy it like a Rottweiler on a toy for like 5 minutes. My parents would get us a toy drum set. We'd beat the crap out of it, ruin the heads, until finally they were like, okay, like three Christmases in a row of getting these kits, we got to finally actually get a real drum set. So we went down to Ozzy's Music. And by the way, the town that I lived in, and it will come back around again in this, it's a town called Poway in San Diego. It's like pretty east. They call it like, has one of these nicknames like, a slice of country in the city, or city.
Yeah,
you get it.
Yeah,
any combination of those words, sure. you'll fill the blanks.
Yeah. Right,
city in the country. There we go. So the town was Poway. We got a drum set, a CB700 Sparkle Red Wine kit from Ozzy's Music.
Who's we? Your parents and you and
brother
and your brother. So was he also playing drums?
Yeah, I mean, I think like brothers. Kind of share the same shit, you know, like
how close are you in age?
4 years apart. And he became a bit of a, like a filter of new music too. You know, like I would say discovering music came from peers and listening to the radio quite a bit too. And then and stuff that would kind of funnel through him. And we were still at this point pretty young. Like this is, you know, 10, 12, like it's pretty young. They started early with a drum kit. This thing was super loud. Neighbors hated it. My parents probably got it because they thought we'd just stay home more. You know, if you're like home, the idea is that you'll get into less trouble because you'll be less ballsy to really break the law within the house, which wasn't always the case. So we got this drum kit. And that was my first instrument. And still to this day, I'm sort of a bit of a hack guitar player. That came later. So I learned the drums and I took drum lessons and never got like crazy good. I mean, I think at that point the goal was like, if one day I could join the marching band, that would be so awesome because they do these like fancy paradiddles and stick clicks and got to wear the outfits. And I probably love the theatrics of it all more than anything, you know, like the idea of coming up and playing instrument, the idea was like, maybe one day the instrument is going to be this spaceship that could take me to a stage.
Right.
You know, that was like the goal. Like someone gets a Les Paul or like an American Strat. That was always the thing. Like, oh my gosh, is it an American Strat? Holy shit, it's the Holy Grail instrument. You know, like, you know, where it would spread like wildfire when someone would get a sick instrument in the neighborhood. And then there's a few lightning rod moments that planted instruments in my hand. One was discovering Back to the Future.
Yeah.
And I've come across a few friends of mine that like had a musical moment watching Back to the Future. And I don't know if it's a combination of like the innocence and the age and the time in America and all of those sorts of things.
Huey Lewis was huge. And it was like the, you know, like a massive push towards that. Plus that was the biggest movie. It was a different time where movies were made for, it felt like for adolescent boys.
Oh, dude, it was crazy.
Like that you had all those movies that were happening in the mid 80s were made for like teenage girls and adolescent boys. Felt like those were like the demographics. So many movies based in that mindset, and now I don't feel like that's really the case. It's like they're, it's like blockbusters, yeah. Or it's Netflix.
Imagine if like Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter somehow snuck someone who shredded at guitar halfway in the probably
yeah, Bill
a different
and Ted's.
music scene. Yeah.
That's sort of what that is.
Exactly. It's probably So that and La Bamba.
Yeah.
One still will bring me to my knees. Anytime I want to like get in touch with my emotions, the last 10 minutes of La Bamba will take me down crying anytime. That's free therapy right there.
Yeah.
My dad had an electric guitar that was kind of stashed away that I started kind of picking up and playing a couple of chords. I was still pretty young and like just learned a few riffs. At that time, it was just cover songs. And then We ended up moving around quite a bit. Like when I was living in San Diego, at that time my mom was in real estate, and I went to four different elementary schools, three different junior highs, and then
so you know like standard friends. Music becomes your one steady.
It's just kind of a little bit, yeah. You're the kid on the block that's making friends because you have the drum set in the room and like some amps and a guitar or whatever. Yeah. And then my dad got the call to work, and they were moving to Colorado, and it was just this total devastation. Like, oh my God, I'm moving halfway through junior high, you know, the first year of junior high to Colorado, and moved out there, and it was just kind of a short stint. It was like 2 years there. Kind of got into like the mountains and skiing and all that sort of stuff. And the drums lived in the basement. They probably got a little more dusty than in years past. And then from there, this is now like early high school. Then we moved to the Bay Area. And that was probably when moment of adolescence where like you where everything kind of comes into focus. You're like you wear your interests like on your sleeve. You're like and we were talking about this a friend of mine earlier today actually about like there was a moment in time where you could see someone like rock across the street wearing a pair of, you know, Chuck Taylors and black jeans and probably guess what five bands they listen to.
Yeah.
Now we live in such a different world. Yeah. We have no idea. But yeah, when I lived in the Bay Area, then it was like started dyeing my hair, started getting into like Green Day. Now this is 90s. So it's like in prime 90s.
So
like
at this point you're playing guitar.
So now I'm starting to play guitar. Like prime 90s, like it's like Nirvana. Then a couple years later, it's like Green Day, and it's bands like Faith No More and Lollapalooza and Smashing Pumpkins. And like that was just couldn't get away from it. It was just
Butch Vig era.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And that was my life. That was my uniform every day. And that's how.
When did you start writing songs?
So then, really, I didn't start writing songs till. I moved down from graduate high school, moved from the Bay Area down to Santa Barbara, and got turned on. I had a roommate that turned me on to like all the stuff that I think influenced some of the things that I was a big fan of. Like I started like Green Day was a gateway to some of like other bands that had that same tempo, and then I started getting into what types of music that influenced, you know, those records. Like Elvis Costello, like really clever songwriting. All of a sudden now lyrics became important and I wasn't just following, just melodies. But I think kind of a few things. I had a lightning rod moment that was probably chemically induced at Lollapalooza when I was in high school. And that was like, holy shit, I want to play music for the rest of my life. This is it. I found it at an early age. This gave me like the vision, the mission statement, and set my GPS coordinates for a life of this, of what we do. But I started taking like actual songwriting seriously or somewhat seriously when I was, when I was living in Santa Barbara. I had an acoustic guitar. I started kind of dissecting some of these songs. And I think what was cool at the time was like Nirvana songs were pretty easy to sing and play, and they didn't require like a ton of vocal range. So they were just easy songs to pull off. And then it became, I had an acoustic guitar all the time. I was just the guy that was probably like the weirdo that had the acoustic. I traveled with it everywhere. And then it became like,
and you, now you still
going,
are.
Going up and like meeting girls and singing songs. And like, and that was the thing. I was the asshole that like tried serenading a room with an acoustic guitar at a party.
Yeah, man.
That probably really pissed a lot of people off.
Like, still dude, living that.
Get that guy out of there.
Still my life to this day, dude.
Totally. I know. I thought about
the cool thing about Nirvana and also being a drummer. First of all, Dave Grohl is the most singable drummer of all time. It's like you can sing all those drum parts. This sounds like a racial stereotype, but white people, when they try to write songs and they think they're writing melodies, they think that means a lot of notes. But they think up and down, down and up, long, short, but they don't think really rhythm. Mm-hmm. They don't think about how singable rhythms can be and how hooky rhythms can be. They're always looking for that crazy, you know, We Are Young melody, and they're much less likely to write, you know, this really quirky syncopated, the kind of melody that a drummer would write. Yeah. And there's a reason why Foo Fighters ended up being so huge, and it's because you had a drummer as the lead singer. And if you grow up listening to Nirvana and that era, especially if you're a drummer, so you're attuned to it, I can imagine that being a massively positive influence on writing. If the first songs you're playing, because if you're playing Carter Beauford, you know, like early Dave Matthews, it's really hard to like sing those parts. There might be some hooks here or there, but you'd have to be just a genius to be able to write that in a melody. But you could write a melody to all of those Dave Grohl.
Totally, yeah. Parts. And he's the ultimate drummer, that like plays for the song, obviously. But so I started writing songs and I remember just having a summer where I just got totally bitten by the bug. And I've heard this happening with other people that got into their sort of year one of writing songs. And I think one summer I wrote like 25 songs. None of them were any good. They were just little verses and choruses. But for me, I was just trying to figure out. I mean, it was just very self-taught. I was just trying to figure out and copy, like learn as much covers as possible, kind of get an idea of what's going on in those songs. Some of it a bit subconscious, knowing that, okay, well, chorus needs to lift, probably need to get to it, you know, within a certain amount of time. And I was just writing these really innocent sounding like pop songs.
Do you remember the first song you wrote?
Yeah, it was terrible.
What was it called?
It was called something like Red. Oh yeah, if I had an acoustic, I could probably figure it out.
But I only see
six
right
acoustics
here.
Around. Yeah, here. So exactly. Like, why would I ever want to do it? No. We do it. But I'll, it was like red hair and she don't care. And it was about my friend's golden retriever.
Oh,
really deep.
What's the Beatles one about? The one that's in, it's in D, it's in on the White Album. It's like the third song on the album. I'll figure it out. But they have one that was about it. Yeah, people write about dogs.
If the Beatles did it, then of course, like, give some slack.
songwriters. You could be the grand prize winner and score up to $5,000 in cash, one of 12 Martin guitars, as well as a mentoring session with El King, Joe London, or myself. The lyric winner will win an opportunity to be mentored by award-winning songwriter Tom Douglas, as well as other coveted prizes. Enter the 20th annual NSAI Song Contest presented by Martin Guitar Strings and CMT now through October 31st at nsai.cmt.com. NSAI, the National Songwriters Association International, is one of the biggest supporters of songwriters and played a major role in helping pass the Music Modernization Act, a historical piece of legislation that allows you to have a future as a songwriter. This is your opportunity to experience industry access, one-on-one mentorship with hit songwriters, and fund your creative passions. Song and lyric-only categories are open now for submissions. We can't wait to hear your songs. This week's episode is sponsored by BMI. At BMI, music moves their world just like it moves mine. BMI is my performing rights organization. They're the bridge between people who create music like me and the businesses that bring it to the public. They make sure I get paid when my music is streamed on apps or shows, played on radio, at live shows, or in bars, gyms, basically anywhere where music is played. And they do this for over 900,000 songwriters, composers, and music publishers with more than 14 million songs across genres. But it's more than that. They help us navigate the music industry. They create opportunities for aspiring writers and composers through stages at festivals, song camps, and workshops. And they connect us with the right people. They're also on Capitol Hill fighting for copyright protection and fair royalties. And they work hard to ensure the future of music. They have my back and they'll have yours. Learn more at BMI.com. This episode is brought to you by Abco Music, home to iconic music catalogs of the 20th century, including Sam Cooke, Ray Davies, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, and Bobby Womack. Whoa. Let's rewind. Mick Jagger, Keith Richards. They've also been an advocate for the songwriting community for the last 50 years. So go check out www.abco.com. That's ABKCO.com.
So I started writing some songs and I could tell they were getting a little better. And I started pulling together, some friends to start a band. And this is still in Santa Barbara. And I was going to the community college up there. And I had I had somewhat of a demo. I mean, my demo at the time was just me singing into like a dictaphone recording. And out of nowhere, I remember coming home from like a class one day, and on my voicemail was someone that worked at Warner Brothers Records. And it was like, hey, I heard you're a songwriter, and someone told me about your music, and
who,
I really like
to meet
you.
Who was it who heard it?
He is someone who's not in the business anymore. And it was like kind of a younger guy at the company, and ended up turning into, and I'll get there in a second.
How did they hear these demos?
A friend of mine was playing his music for somebody, and in the small talk of like, oh, where are you from? Or is there like, what's the music scene like up in Santa Barbara? Is there anything like up there that I should know about? And my buddy said, oh yeah, actually there's this guy who's a friend of mine, Tim, you know, and he's like probably going to start a band, and he's writing these cool songs. You should check him out. He came up, and I like sang this guy some songs, and we ended up like continuing talking. And I ended up signing a terrible production deal. That I will say this for the listeners out there: if anyone gives you a contract, have somebody look it over, not like a family attorney, but like a legit attorney, like five times, because there was a moment where we like could have signed something crazy, like 50% of publishing and 50% of everything for seven albums if we got a record deal within this time frame. It was like the deepest, it was like the deepest production deal, and it, luckily it ended up lapsing. But we ended up getting a development deal at Warner Brothers where they had us like, so I put a band together and called it Sugar Cult, and we came down to LA and recorded at a super fancy studio and recorded a few songs that were terrible. Thankfully, we got passed on.
Why thankfully you got passed on?
Oh, they were just like, we were so green at the time.
Did you think they were good at the time? Or were you like, oh, this is not?
Probably, but like in hindsight, it was just so different than what we ended up becoming as a band. So then really, I think we went back to Santa Barbara from the start of like forming Sugar Cult, our band, to then getting a record deal. It was a pretty short amount of time. It was like a year and a half. And we just like played. It was a great town to start a band in, where the local radio station would play us. We were pretty self-contained. Our drummer, Ben, had this awesome, like super primitive, like digital four track where we would make these demos that sounded pretty decent. And they would get played on the radio. And we would play these venues up there like the Wildcat and, gosh, the one called the Yucatan, and there's so many. There's a place called the Living Room that would do all ages shows out in Goleta, and
people were just passing your music along, and that's were you just sort of, it didn't matter who was showing up, or building a following?
We were kind of building a following. It was like we sped our music up like 20 BPM and found a place for our music. We were super high energy. We were like big on style at the time. We all wore suits. We all thought we were like a power pop band from like the late 70s. That was like the model. And
but it was kind of back at that point. Maybe
that was
partly because what you were doing was bringing it back.
It was cool. We're like the tightest like black, like now it's gotten so easy to get cool tight black pants. Back then you'd have to buy Dickies and take them to a tailor and be like, you have to explain to somebody why you want to make these things like as tight as spandex.
Wearable pants.
Yeah, right. Like by the time I put these on, I've cut circulation off to like every major artery in my body. Yeah. So we played shows galore up there and then started coming down to LA. And the idea was like, we were so hungry. We had the dream of every young artist and band. We're like, we want to fucking take over the world and travel and meet our heroes and all of that. So we started making trips down to LA and sending off our demo and like doing showcases back in the day where like people would rent out a club and A&R people would show up like 3 hours late and be on their cell phone the whole time and like maybe catch half a song. It was just such a different vibe. Every label passed on us. At one point, Tori Spelling's younger brother like wanted to start a record label and we were all excited because he wanted to sign us, but it really wasn't a label. I think he just wanted to sign us so we'd hang out with him type of thing. And at that point we're like, fuck yeah, we're game. Anyway, we ended up signing with a better label called Ultimatum, who at the time, their only claim to fame was they had Keanu Reeves' band, Dogstar.
Yeah, Dogstar was really actually like a big LA band. Yeah. If you knew Dogstar, like they played the Key Club and they'd be playing, like they were a big band.
Yeah, so we were label mates with Dogstar. Never got to meet Keanu. I still think, you know, I would probably be frozen in his beauty. Guy's ageless. Have you been keeping up on like the feeds lately? He's like,
yeah. Just, I mean, like he's just in a movie recently where he played himself. I can't remember what the movie was. It was like
there's
a movie
younger.
Recently where he plays himself, where it's like, and then she starts dating Keanu Reeves, and he's like, yeah, the guy's amazing.
Yeah,
they're actually redoing Bill and Ted's right now.
Great.
Yeah, they're doing Bill and Ted's 3 with him.
Maybe they need some songs for the soundtrack.
They do. We'll talk about it later.
We'll do a side deal after this.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
weird when it comes to when you're aspiring to be a musician. Like you were saying, you know, have somebody check your contracts. You know, it's like you will take. On some level, I believe in walk through doors. If someone's going to open a door, walk through it. You know, within reason. But when it's mid 90s, late 90s, and Tori Spelling's brother, when you're like, well, that's somehow 1 degree of separation from some of the biggest actors in the biggest TV show with 90210, and like the dad is this like massive rich person. There starts to be this like weird logic game in that, where you're like, well, had that happened, then they're probably worse record deals. You know, I mean, like, all things considered, if you're in LA and you're an actor, you take whatever show you go, you audition and you get in, you hope that you don't become the face of a, you know, like a toilet paper campaign, but you would have taken that job, you know, because that's what you get. And musicians, it's like, it's kind of the same thing. So if you're in a band and that band and some label offers you a deal, you want that music to come out. If they're willing to spend money on you and partner with you on trying to break you.
For me, more situations. When I moved to LA, so we had finally come down here and got a manager. I was working at J. Crew out in Topanga, which I think is still might be there. And I was folding sweaters by day and playing like the Opium Den by night. I would show up in where the conservative part, and then the second I was out of there, putting on like black eyeliner and spiking my hair and doing like Sid Vicious snarls and singing like cute pop punk songs. So it was a bit of a double life. And you're right, like you know, you're in at that time, you're just hoping that, man, there's gonna be like maybe someone in the crowd that works at a record company, and you know, might like a huge victory, be like, dude, someone gave us a business card, holy shit. They may work at a label or have a roommate that works at a label. You'd sign anything. Yeah. Like, it was that, or like my reality was, you know, and it's still the reality of a lot of people. So I get it. Like, it's like that, a shitty record deal, or deliver pizzas, I'll take a shitty record deal anytime.
Yeah.
You know.
When did you realize that, you know, you start hearing Sugar Cult on, like, K-Rock? You start, I mean, I know I jumped ahead a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's good. We're there.
But, like, you know, you're hearing it. I assume your family's able to tune into some radio stations and hear it, too. Or at least they were able to see you. Did you ever think that the artist thing would stop, or how was the relationship between the guys in the band?
And everything is still like totally cool and PC and great with the band, and we're not nearly as active. We haven't played a show in a long time, and we actually never said we're like the band's broken up, just life kind of got busy. But what we ended up doing is we toured for about 10 years and made 3 records. And that band brought me to places. And this is the one great thing about being an artist and getting into music. Like, everyone has their own path and how they get here. Mine happens to be I was an artist first and did that. And that was really my college, you know. We got to – it's like you have this all-expense-paid trip to travel the world. It's a shitload of work. And I will say that prepared me for the life that I have now. That's – in production and songwriting, which is like super competitive. You have to have crazy thick skin which is hard for, you know, a sensitive weirdo like myself. But, you know, we toured for like, what, you made 3 records, toured a ton, got songs on the radio, got songs on MTV, hosted shows, played massive festivals, opened for some of the biggest bands in the world, developed a following. And I think that kind of taught us how to, and we were so young too. I was like in my early 20s, literally went from working at J. Crew and doing like summer landscaping jobs and barely making enough money to buy Taco Bell with no add-ons. I mean, we're not talking like, there's like the Supreme menu is like 50 cents more. This was low-tech Taco Bell lifestyle to then. And even like the advance, when we finally got an advance, when we got a record deal, was still pretty low dough compared to, you know, probably some of the stuff going on at the time. But
split.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you finally get the advance and you're like, oh, we're good to go. And you're like, wow, this split 3 ways and we better make some money on some of these shows eventually. And hopefully merch keeps you.
We had 6 months. Yeah. We had 6 months in our advance before we had to then go back to jobs. It was like 40 grand. Not including paying taxes and all of the commissions and all that kind of stuff. So then broken out 4 ways and you're like, you better be living real cheap because you got 6 months to pull it off. So we made a record with Matt Wallace. The first tour we got was the Warped Tour, which
was right in its prime.
Like too. Totally in the prime. Yeah. And that was at the time like so perfect for the scene. And that is like another, you know, experience that kind of informs how I work with artists now, because we did so much touring and we never really had like a quote unquote like big radio hit. We didn't get to have like number ones, but we toured so much and we were part of a scene and we really tried creating a world for our fans, and developed a really loyal following that would pack shows. And this was like the type of thing that not only was it, was our touring in America, but we toured Japan a ton and then toured like the UK a ton. And that's something that I don't see a lot of bands doing now as much, say on a first record. They really kind of focus on the States. So we did that for 10 years. And then
the music you grew up on was pretty diverse.
Sure.
And, you know, there's diversity within the Warped Tour bands.
And a lot of melody too, a ton.
There's a lot of melody.
And we're seeing a lot of that melody coming back through a lot of hip hop records now too.
Sure.
Which I think's cool.
Do you think that because of Sugar Cult and because of Warped Tour and because of, you know, the radio stations you would play with, that influences the kinds of artists you work with, or is it just sort of like a coincidence?
No,
I think you became the guy who produces those bands.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that my sense of familiarity and what I know is stuff that's a little bit more alternative. But I love pop music too. You know, I want to try to. I love the writing songs that live in an alternative space that might not be as tight sometimes as pop songs at all, but no, fuck it. I take that back. Now I want to try to get to choruses quickly. Sometimes I just try to hide.
Well, one of the things you do the reason why I mention your intuition super unique is that you, especially with the Neon Tree stuff, you would end the pre-chorus with the chorus.
Yeah.
You start the chorus earlier. You start not just before the one, but like you literally, like, this gets pretty dorky, but like you sing the chorus hook is how you end a lot of the pre-choruses.
Yeah. There was a moment there where we were doing this thing on Neon Tree songs where we'd write a full chorus and then we'd figure out ways to even like take two bars out of the middle of the chorus so the repeat happens a little faster. And no one really caught that on Animal and Everybody Talks. I was waiting for us to get like kind of busted on it, but then again, they'd bust us for our own
the compositional police.
Yeah.
Just get like a random text from me being like, yo man, can't do that. You cannot do that.
I'm calling you on it.
You cannot do that. You're busted.
So
such a weird scenario.
Some of the stuff is totally you can only plan so much. Some of it is pretty accidental. And I think probably the first time it happened with Animal, that was a bit of an accident.
But you have to trust it because you know it's an accident then, but you could easily say, okay, well, look, we know, let's just keep adding to it. But instead, you're not, but it actually sounds pretty cool making that choice of,
I probably didn't think about it as much in the early days. Now I'm probably a little more methodical too, you know, about it. But to get from Sugar Cult into producing records and even that part of my life, it's pretty funny because with Neon Trees, they were one of the first bands that I had ever produced. And this happened and wrote with, and this happened towards the end of our last Sugar Cult record. We had toured a ton and we're probably kind of feeling a little bit crispy. And on the last tour, we had come across Neon Trees and they were just a local band playing in St. George, Utah. And there was just something about them that was like just electric and cool. And it was at the time, the only original members now would be the singer and the singer and the guitar player ended up staying, and the two other guys went off and did something else. But they were just really talented, and I remember watching them play, and there was all these crazy technical difficulties on the stage. But the singer like totally kept his composure and was super funny and charming. And I thought, you know, that was always the hardest part in touring, where like when mayhem and chaos goes on stage, which could easily happen like every other night at a club tour, how you're holding it together so the audience is entertained and having fun and there's banter holding it all together is like so critical to a good performer. So I stayed in touch with those guys, Tyler specifically, and they ended up getting a deal like probably 6 months later, and they were coming out to LA, and they were like, oh, we should, you know, we're coming out to LA to work on some tunes. There's a couple of people that the record company wants us to meet. Would you want to get in the room and you know, work on some songs together? And that was like one of my first, honestly, one of my first real co-writes. So I went down to the studio earlier that day. I kind of started putting together a little bit of a track just to be able to have...
Whose idea was it to start co-writing? Or were we just like, oh, let's write together?
It was, I think it was a combination of the Evan at the label sent them, Evan Lipschitz at the label, this is Island, had planned a trip for them to come out. And by the way, this is back, you know, this is 2009 when co-writing really wasn't the thing. And it was a little bit like, for alternative bands, for alternative bands, it was like, it was not as received. You were totally like the secret in the back room as a
Why do you think that was?
Well, I think some of it had to do with, you know, and by the way, and I totally get it. Like the artist, I think the artist wants probably to feel a certain sense of autonomy that all of the creative. And again, I'm not speaking for them because I've had an incredibly awesome relationship with them. We've done a bunch of records together. But I think in general, like if I were to sort of pull a lot of the bands that I worked with at that time, like we would work on records, make records. I would be involved and write songs with the band, and they would be asked questions about how did the writing come together, and would never get mentioned. And you would be like, whoa, man, that's... You know,
did you fight for publishing at that point, or were you well, you know, I'm still a producer, and producers don't get writing credit?
No, at the time, these were set up as writing sessions, but I think they just kind of kept the co-write stuff a little hush hush. It wasn't as, it's just a little bit different than now, and I don't know if it's alternative music, it was a kind of a genre thing.
When something like Neon Trees starts to cross over, because that was a pretty big pop record.
So that was, by the way, what was crazy about that session, and these happen fucking once every, like, never. I mean, they're insane. So
yeah.
We sit down, first time real, like, honestly, like, first time session pretty much. Had a couple of other things before that, nothing that crazy. And I put together a little simple track, and I was literally just like testing out like equipment, like, okay, does this drum beat work? Does this guitar align? Like, is everything tracking into the computer to be able to like then work on the real song? And Tyler, the singer, walks in and he's like, oh, that's pretty cool. And it kind of had sounded like sort of a new wave strokesy type of song. And he sits down, he just starts singing like Animal, which was the first song that we ended up writing together. And that was ended up being fast forward a year, whatever it was, 6 months later, like a year. But at the time, I mean, I always thought that song was really was super strong, but it was funny. We did that song and ended up doing more with the band. And I'll never forget, after like writing like four songs together, they're like, oh, this is so awesome. So, you know, we're going to leave next month and now record the record with somebody else. And I was like, what? Oh my gosh. Thinking the whole time, like,
you're producing.
Well, yeah, we're doing this together. And they ended up recording it with somebody else on the East Coast. And it didn't turn out as good as they wanted it. And they ended up coming back, and we basically, like, for the most part, kind of like remixed the demos with a few live drums on it. And that was the record. And like, even like when I go back and think about like the day that this just kind of keeps coming back in my life in general. Like, nobody knows when songs are hits. Like, you just don't know. Like, I sent the song in to the label and I didn't hear back. I didn't hear back from them for like about a month and a half after sending in the song that ended up later on becoming like
the defining
selling
song.
Like yeah, 3 million copies and like defining, you know, my career early on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So what I was going to say is, you know, you get this success in songs that cross over and you see what pop is. Now, I guess on some level what's weird is, the success you had previous to that was from Sugar Cult. So the amount of money you made from writing for Sugar Cult wasn't as much as you made from touring for Sugar Cult, I would assume, and merch and all the other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and from record sales and all the other things you got. But when you start seeing what radio pays and then when you see what pop radio pays, did you feel like you should be aiming for music that was out of your wheelhouse? Was there ever pressure
not
to
really,
be like?
But I will say, yeah, the first time I got a check that probably reflected like a window of pop radio, I definitely had one of those keel over, holy shit moments. You know, maybe a tear was shed.
Yeah,
like it
for
was.
Sure.
My goal was just to never get to a place where I had to deliver pizzas, or not that. Maybe I'll do it one day as a hobby, but like I just didn't want. I wanted to avoid like. I just had every shit job under the sun before getting into this. And like, I feel like I never had a bit of a backup plan. So when I started having success as a songwriter, producer coming out of Sugar Cult and these songs that were intended to be really just these kind of like alternative new wave, you know, almost kind of Strokes meets Depeche Mode inspired pop songs, we had no idea. Like, holy crap, like nothing about the project at the time was this, you know, some of these things now you hear about these projects that are like a lot of A&R people are involved. You get like the whispers of like people from higher up going like, we're really going to pull a trigger on this band and take it all the way. There was like none of that. It was just, it took forever to climb. And it was like the number one most played song that year on K-Rock. And then all of a sudden, like 6 months later, broke some record of like the longest charting, like, or like the longest climbing song. And then all of a sudden it starts getting played on the pop radio. And there was a few songs at the time that were kind of doing a little bit of that, like that Owl City song that was like their breakout one. It kind of had a little bit of that. But there just wasn't as many models the way there have been at the time. Like there wasn't the fun song and there wasn't the pumped up kicks and there wasn't, you know, Imagine Dragon references where like really big alternative songs could cross to pop. There just was, it was so, so unheard of for that to happen. And for me, you know, like how I write songs and what I bring to songs and what I try to bring to the productions, I'm kind of doing my thing. Like I'm doing, when I try to do something that would say, would be, sound like pop, it's probably by most people's definition, not pop.
Right.
It's through my filter. So, you know, there's certain things that I'm subconsciously do in my songwriting or production or help influence in songs. I'm always trying to find a little bit of a left turn. I probably spend just as much time on a song trying to make it weird and doing the thing that you wouldn't expect as I would, you know, and that's something that I'm even now kind of trying to unlearn a little bit, because I have a 4-year-old daughter and she listens to some of the most cool, simple music that I love, you know, and I'm like listening to Taylor Swift songs in the morning now going like, fuck, oh, I really got to maybe just stick to this 4-chord thing.
Yeah.
There's something smart about that. And I ended up having a session the other day with Jean from St. Lucia where where we, it was a kind of a perfect opportunity where I was just listening to the last Taylor Swift song with my daughter in the kitchen, and we were singing it at the top of our lungs, making pancakes. And I had a session later that day, and it was like a perfect opportunity where we were working on a song, having a bit of a stumbling block and like trying to write a verse. And the answer was, you know, hey, I'm not that inspired. You know, he wasn't that inspired. Let's try changing the track all, you know, to something different that might spark a melody. And I was like, no, man, let's stick to these four chords. Like, let's try it. That's where I think sometimes the discipline and the craft comes into play, where, you know, certain types of songs happen and it's total divine intervention. And then other types of songs are written where it's like a bit of a grind and the craft and the like, and it's the, and it's the jigsaw puzzle that's worth fighting for.
Yeah.
Of course, I love the freebies more than anyone else when these fucking things just happen and it feels like you just got to pass in life. But for the most part, most kind of, it's inspiring, you know, somewhere in that term. But I don't know, like, being too envious is definitely such a slippery slope because, you know, you like, in the name of self-preservation, you try as hard as you can to try to, you know, not be chasing something to a point of being totally unhealthy and, like, that can really get you fucking depressed. But, you know, there's a lot, just, there's incredible music out these days, and there's a lot of music that's taking some just amazing chances, and I think that, you know, when I think about the last 15 years of music and where, if you were to follow, like, from the life of a record producer, writer, going from, like, you know, producing songs to tape, to then Pro Tools, and then awesome experimental things that people are doing in Ableton in their bedroom, to like now this, like we're into EDM, to now we're like, I'm loving cool, minimal, dark pop. I think we live in just a really interesting time for music. Sometimes I don't totally understand it. In those moments, I'm, you know, even though I'm an established producer, you have these moments where you're like, fuck, I need to do some deep digging. Like I'm having a hard time getting what's so awesome about right. something if I'm not fully getting it. Like even, like I was listening yesterday to like the Lil Nas X record with a young producer that works with me, and I was like, okay, well, I'm not fully getting the songs, but I'm getting something out of it that I would love to bring to an alternative production, which is happening more and more often because I am in the hunt for sounds and things that will help inspire a co-write in the room. Because that, I feel like that's kind of my job. Like when I was in Sugar Cult, I was writing songs with an acoustic guitar, singing, and the responsibility was totally on me. Now the sessions are, it's my job to inspire the room, and I'll help participate, but I also typically work with artists that really enjoy writing lyrics and want to write, and so I occupy a different type of footprint in those rooms.
Do you seek out those artists?
I think so. Or
do they seek you out for being someone that allows them to write lyrics?
It's probably a little bit of both. You know, most of my meetings come from, or most of my projects come from hearing demos. I have to be a fan of anything I work with, and I have to feel like that I can contribute in some way. And even if the contribution has helped define what they're doing, like you get the, and I'm sure this happens to all of us, you'll get the Dropbox link of a bunch of songs and they are all over the place. And you're like, and they may be really, everyone's good in this town. They may be like really fucking compelling, super tight, pro sounding demos, but they're all over the place. If their art and their music is a business, which it is, the audience has no idea who the artist is because it's like one song's, they're just 10 different genres and all over the place. So sometimes my contribution when I'm meeting somebody is to help pull, like wrangle in a sound or identify glimmers of what I think could be cool and try to illuminate that. So I would say that like in this role and in this life of being a collaborator, producer, writer, it's I kind of have to wear a lot of hats. And luckily with alternative music, the sound has changed so much that it probably started off at one point being dominated by a lot of bands, and now things are just feeling a little bit more pop, and there's a lot of cool things that have influenced, you know, alternative music that have helped that. And I think a lot of pop records now are also even influencing a lot of alternative stuff.
Yeah, I heard Billie Eilish on K-Rock today, and you know, it reminds me of sort of when Lorde was on K-Rock too, and you're totally. Like, well, it's a real fine line between what's alt rock, what's pop, and you know, when it, the old definition of what popular music is, and it's like, oh yeah, it can, it's sort of a genreless thing. It's funny. Well,
and it is hard. Like sometimes I have a hard time, like also knowing like what's alt and what's not. I've had a project recently where we were like having that discussion. Like I did a production and it turned into like everyone's needed to sound more alt or whatever maybe the critique was. And it was like, well, wait a second. There's like, by whose definition? There's like six different versions of what that even means now.
Yeah.
You know, and by the way, none of them are right. And for me, the one thing I'd say is the songs that I've worked on that have been hits or big hits were never the sound of radio at the time anyway. And that's something that I have to remind myself too, because you know, like we can all feel like we're all guilty of like checking out when stuff comes out, New Music Friday, and you're like, "Fuck, this sounds so inventive and so futuristic," and gosh, I need to like up. And I probably went through a period last year where myself and Brian, who's a young producer that works with me, we just listen to stuff and be like, "Damn, this shit's sounding so like futuristic and crazy," and we gotta. And you would maybe like spend a week trying to push yourself in those directions, and then nothing would become of it. And then like when you're just being yourself, that's when things click. So that's something that I think it's something that's really important. And if I were to point to the records that I've had success at, it's when you're yourself, like just be the absolute best version of what you do and like, stop the nonsense of the chasing. Like, put an end to it. It will just make you miserable. It will, you know, if I'm gonna belly flop, it's gonna be on my own.
I knew this guy who was a lawyer who their client didn't have the money to pay, but they had a Picasso sketch, and the son found the painting underneath the bed, the sketch. Was like, why didn't you put this up? And he said, because it's ugly. And it reminds me that it's like, even great artists, it's not like everything they did was great.
Yeah.
You know, it's important. It's so easy to look at the highlight reel and be like, oh man, these guys are geniuses. And they are, you know, but what comes along with that is a lot of crap. And an abundance of crap. And a majority crap. There are very few people where everything they do or a majority of what they do is genuinely at the level it needs to be.
You have to put yourself out there and not be afraid to suck, for sure. And when you put in terms of like, I don't know if anyone follows baseball, but it's like a kick-ass hitter is batting 300.
Yeah.
That's a lot of misses. And by the way, that guy is like, if you're hitting 300, you're getting paid a lot of money. The fans are on their feet cheering when you're walking up to the plate and you're like a badass slugger. I would say for songwriting.
And you were going to get out 7 out of 10 times with that.
Yeah. My hard drive, like, is full of songs that, you know, I even think some of them are shitty, and some of them even are really good, but you know, maybe, you know, there was like the artist or the record label or all the things didn't kind of come together to help push it. There's a lot of also
a hard line drive. It was like a snagged home run. It's like you could have all these
some
things,
of it's luck.
Totally. Last question before I get to the next segment, only because I've asked two kind of significant questions with the OCD and envy. You've mentioned a couple times how it's like you don't want to be a you know, pizza delivery man.
Sure.
No offense to the people who deliver pizzas out there.
I love them. And when they come, the first thing I do is like kiss them on the lips and say, thank you for this pizza. It is going to fuel the session.
Yeah.
And you'll get a room split out of it.
Perfect. That's very sweet of you. Yeah. Do you have PTSD with like not having...
From
like,
the business?
do you worry that you're going to end up back in that place of having those shitty jobs?
No, not now. I would say, and if there was any advice I would give to people out there listening that are getting into this, when you make money, don't do stupid shit and buy a ridiculous car or Gucci head to toe, unless it's at the swap meet and looks super legit, but is like 1/4 the price. I mean, because it can look pretty fly, but
sure.
Don't spend your money on it.
Right.
When you make money, invest. You know, I know that's probably not the most rock and roll topic to get into, but seriously, like when I, you know, something that's not really, really talked about, I think a lot of times artists and songwriters are pretty naive. They're pretty left brain. That's creative, right? Left brain?
I don't know.
Sure. For the sake of this point.
Sure.
Yeah, pretty.
It's one of the two.
Pretty 50% chance. Pretty left brain and don't really think about finances and when you make money, what are you going to do with it? Are you going to go out and buy the car? And it's, I think probably especially in a town like Los Angeles where it's like so opulent and so showy, and you know, I've seen a lot of people rip through their dough and have to take on projects that they don't want to do because of money. Be smart with investing. I don't know if how it's a direct answer to your question, but the PTSD of going back to, sometimes I say it figuratively speaking. I mean, I want to be, my goal is to always feel like I'm doing everything I can to be inspired by the music I'm working on and able to, and I'm allowed enough bandwidth in the session with the people that I'm working on that I can be myself and make the song better and be able to, filter it through my taste. It's why they're hiring me in the first place. People aren't calling me because of the songs that no one's ever heard of. It's pretty obvious why I get the gigs that I do, and it will be, you know, and a lot of times it comes down to like 3 or 4 songs in a career, and I try to make sure that I'm bringing what I brought to those songs to everything that I'm working on, regardless of style. It doesn't matter what. You know, there's just a few kind of hard and fast things that I do in sessions or like...
It takes a lot of perspective to get to that point. And that I think is, you know, a thing that we talk about a lot is just my job right now is when it comes to this podcast is often looking at, you know, you talk about the highlights and you talk about the human and you realize that some of these people who are in the Songwriter Hall of Fame might have 3 songs, you know? They might have the song, but it's just one. They may have written 1,500 songs, but they have one song that worked.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the reason why we're talking about them right now. The other side is there are people who are very accomplished songwriters who've made a living and have never written that song. Or they have a lot of songs that are keeping him going.
Oh yeah.
So you know, the people who tend to have who've had a hit or two recognize how fortunate they really are because they know that there are a couple choices away.
Oh yeah.
From not
if I
having
didn't
that.
If I didn't have time between having hits, I probably have a different like if my success or my career was just like. Hit without space in between, it probably would have a different outlook on it.
Yeah.
But because they've been spaced out, you know, I have just a much different outlook about that in general. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. Like some of these people have had three songs in the Songwriter Hall of Fame and they were writing for 20 years.
Yeah.
I mean, I go to the studio every day at 11. My hours typically are like 11 to midnight, and I am writing and producing every single day. Everything goes through the same filter. You don't stop till like the hair stands up on the back of your neck until you don't stop on an album till you feel like you have singles where, and I probably say this like my mantra is, this is my, I'm quitting music if this song is a hit. Like, there is no way, the world is not a good place if this, whatever the song at the time is. And most often it's not. And then you're on,
you're six months past that by the time you realize
but then
that.
But then you write another song. You're like, okay, no, it's going to be this one. I've changed the song. But
all right, so let's go to the next segment.
Sure.
Five for five. I'm going to name five things. You just tell me the first thing that comes off the top of your head.
Oh, man. I'm so bad at...
Yeah. For the record, for those who can't see what's happening here, our friend Tim here actually brought notes just because he is OCD.
Preparation. I made a couple of notes before coming over.
Okay.
I haven't really looked at them.
No, I was really impressed with you.
They were like just my little... This to me is like my version of... And I'll... Here.
Yeah.
Let's see if it's cutting to the mic. It's like me making a track before the session. If I have a session at noon, I'm palm sweaty at the studio at 10 a.m. putting together two ideas so we can make the most of the day.
All right, so let's go to this next segment because I pulled this out of that. But okay, five for five, Sugar Cult.
Road trips, high fives, hiding booze in cubbies of an RV, and a hell of a lot of fun.
Amazing. Tyler Glenn, Neon Trees.
Bold, daring, inspiring, one of the most talented people I will ever meet.
Pulse Publishing and Jason Bernard.
Amazing. Home base, a wealth of just ideas and knowledge. And they were the first publisher that I signed to, and they took a chance on me. And we had a lot of success together and really positive experience.
Your daughter.
Oh, man. That's like, I'm about to cry. No, amazing. The best thing that could have ever happened. Having a family has given such balance to my life in ways that it was the best decision I could ever make. And this is for someone that, you know, I was probably, I know you're looking for the one-worders, but while we're elaborating, I think doing this type of job and choosing a career in something like this or entertainment or acting, like you need gravity in your life. And whether that's a great relationship with your parents or something that centers you and you chase a lot of shit that doesn't mean a whole lot of anything. And we're just working on music, but having a family brings gravity to all of this. Best decision I ever made.
Well, I was going to have your wife be number five, but I think that's fair. I think she deserves her own time on top of that.
My wife, she's beautiful. She's so sweet. She makes me a better person. And she puts up with so much nonsense. I called her on the way up here because I was nervous about doing this. And I'm a caller when I get out of here and say it went fantastic. It's just the kind of relationship we have.
Well, thank you for doing this. I said in the intro, the reason why I mentioned the writing camp in Aspen in 2012, and I looked it up to make sure that was right, it was sometime in there, was because that was a really transformative experience for me. Because at that time, I was really just trying to figure out, I was out of a band, looked like I had some songs coming out, but I was the lowest on the totem pole, I felt like, at that writing camp, you know, is where I met like Luke Laird and Bonnie McKee's there. And there's like all these like legends. And I remember watching how people were at the camp. And I was so impressed that the way you treated people around you and the way you treated your own success as if it was, you just couldn't be less jaded or seemingly less jaded. The way you communicated your success was a product of being a musician and not like you weren't trying to wear your success on your sleeve in that way.
Oh, thanks.
And I work really hard to try not to be like, to list my own resume.
Mm-hmm.
Because of my own insecurities. And to see, I remember right after that, I went to your studio and you were driving, I think it was your, I want to say like your grandma's car.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the Pontiac Vibe. My mom, or my wife made me sell it because it wasn't safe enough for a baby.
Yeah.
But it was a pretty, yeah.
And I just remember, you know, here we're talking about LA and the desire to fit in is pretty overwhelming at times, and you feel like you need to compete and image, and you let your music do the talking for you, and that takes so much chutzpah, you know.
It's tough in a town like this, but the other day, I don't think, you know, your music speaks for itself, and I don't think people give a shit. I think we invest a lot in these, especially here, you know, these things around us, the cocoons, you know, whether it's nice clothes or a sweet car. And believe me, I've since upgraded. I drive a nicer car now, so I can't fully pull the faux humble ride anymore.
But you also have earned it. The thing is, you didn't go and you aren't spending beyond your means. And when you're saying as advice to a new writer to find investments, that's a way better advice than the person who's going to be like, you know, write your best song. Is like, it's totally, that's also good advice, but it's not. You tell someone to make sure that they don't spend when they get their money is something they could actually use.
Sure, yeah.
And it's not, the way you hold yourself is about the fact that you go in at 11 and you leave at midnight, and that you care about where the hi-hats go. And that is, I mean, that's what we were talking about before this, you know, and that's who you are. And I admire that. It's so much about the work and not about the result. It's so much about the process, and it's about the execution. And when the hair stands on the back of your neck, you have achieved your goal. Not when the song went triple platinum or six-time platinum. And that's why I want to be like that.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. It's all I know. You know, it's my reality. It changes, you know, believe me. I have days where I'm, you know, the worst version of myself and probably, you know, looking at other people's success like we all do. I mean, we're all like, being human, you have in such different ranges of emotions and you're, you know, but if I can live in that skin 4 days a week, I'm feeling pretty good.
Yeah, hell yeah.
You know, today I'm going to head back to the studio and try to achieve those things on a production that I'm working on right now. And that is the most fun. When I think about, you know, when I think about the best times of the day, it's when you're doing that final last mix down, when you're like, holy fuck, we wrote a song. It's pretty amazing. And by the way, like, kudos to songwriters out there. The fact that songs get written in a day and then like produced out in a day is just so insane. Like, coming from the artist world where you'd like torture yourself and try to write a song on an acoustic guitar and like barely schlack together like the most primitive verse and a chorus, to nowadays, you know, we're writing and making songs that could be released on the radio in one day is insane. Like, it's insane. It defies
everything.
It's magic. It's totally magic. It's like, if you're doing that, if you're doing work like that, you are very special and operating on a totally different level. But it's those, when I think the happiest times I have in the studio, it is that final play down. And then it's the car ride listen on the way home in your, and those are, it's probably like the most peaceful, like, blasting of music of, you know, probably the best play down. You know, you're the first person that gets to hear these records, like having worked on that, on the recent Blink stuff, like being the first to hear, like, I was, you know, listener number one on those songs. You know, that's a pretty incredible feeling. Those songs we took them back to the studio, those, the pretty much the demos or the recordings that went down that day and the writing of the song became the song that everyone's hearing, you know? So
sick.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. This has been a great hang. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silberstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.